all we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Welcome. This is Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. It's Here We Stand. And thank you, Martin. Thank you, Odetta, for that. Today we are going to take on our fear and our despair because it's everywhere these days, folks. It's been pumped into us about this so-called vaccine scare, this coronavirus nonsense. It's been pumped at us constantly right now, and we have to look at these things within ourselves and around us. We're going to look at that today, but also go over some things that are very important to talk about, which is how do we conduct this battle on the basis of righteousness, not simply a reaction to somebody else's agenda. And I'm proud to be joined today in that dialogue with Deborah Golding. She's been on before. She's a survivor of the Mormon Church. And I don't want to call her an activist because she's much more than that, but she's that too. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. And before we get into our talk today, I want to remind folks of the fact that if you go to murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates, you'll see some very important updates having to do with an action that's been launched in Vancouver about the West Coast genocide, the ongoing genocide. As you probably know or remember, there's a common law court convening in Vancouver Monday, March 30th. And as part of that action, I have introduced notices of liability to 12 key actors in the West Coast genocide. They have not responded, so a defraud notice, a default notice was issued against them, which allows me then to take the next step and actually bring in liens against these people and citizen arrests. Now, all of this is going to be leading up to not only the common law court, but coming out of that in April, we are resurrecting Aboriginal Holocaust Day on April 15th. But leading into that, we want to commemorate our seven fallen brothers and sisters in Vancouver who died directly as a result of exposing these genocidal churches and calling for their disestablishment. That's Harriet Nahani, Ron Barber, Edna Phillips, Bingo Dawson, William Coombs, Ricky LaValle, and Harry Wilson. All of them died at the hands of the police or in hospitals, foul play. We want to remember those brothers and sisters, and this is how you can do it. Mark this date in your calendar, Easter Sunday, April 12th at 10 a.m. if you're in Vancouver. Rally outside Holy Rosary Catholic Church, that's at Richards and Dunsmuir, the site of many great actions we did, including occupying that church, a direct action which stimulated the official apology a bit later in the year 2007-2008. We're going to go there to remember those brothers and sisters. And if you're not in Vancouver, please do similar actions at Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches in Canada, Catholic, Anglican churches around the world. That's Sunday, that's Easter Sunday, or Resurrection Day, Easter Sunday, April 12th, 10 a.m. outside Holy Rosary Church at 646 Richards at Dunsmuir Street. You can get more of that if you want to write to thecommonland@gmail.com. Okay, Deborah, let's do it. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for asking. I'm excited about how you introduced things here. It's feeling really purposeful and on a very practical and hopeful side of things, and so I'm really, really excited about our conversation today. So,
yeah, and I want to also kind of realize that one of the ways we fight fear and despair is through humor and music.
yeah.
Always, you know, at meetings I've grown up at over the last 45 years in, you know, labor movement, political movements, we had a long tradition where you start meetings with music and song, and mm-hmm. it's a great way to counter all of the shit thrown at us, and that's why I like to play these songs. But also, I do have a number of jokes to share today, and maybe you do too. Mormon jokes.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be good.
I've seen
Mormons
some
laugh.
Funny memes going around. Well, yes. Yeah.
Yep.
Mormons are people too. You know, honestly, it's the humor, if you notice, I mean, if you find something just even to smile at, but if you can move that smile into a giggle even, and then, you know, from there, it can get even more fun. But just if you take a moment, and if you're not smiling right now, right, and you're just kind of listening, think of a time that you had a really good experience with someone or a group of people that you just had one of the funniest moments, and you can think about it right now, and instantly by thinking of that, you can feel your body react. Like, your body actually tunes into that, right? You get a visceral reaction to
what that is.
And so what this is, I mean, when people are like, well, what is this vibrational thing? What do you mean raising my vibration? Well, you just raised your vibration from a baseline of where you were, just it was kind of, you know, neutral. And maybe you were even kind of frustrated and depressed. I don't know, you know, but as a listener, as somebody in your moment right there, to stop, just stop that and say, you know, I remember the time, and you go back to a time when you were laughing with.
Does that include, you know, moments with ex-wives?
It can, of course it does.
Those are the funniest.
Well, see what it's done? I mean, already, you know, you're already raising
right.
your vibration. You're already changing the mood
you're
of what
right.
it is. And I think
right.
that's, well, you know, it's funny too. And this is actually a really perfect segue into something I wanted to share. I've got an associate. She's really a light in my life. I have a number of those, and she happened to have posted something on social media that I thought was really appropriate. Now, for some people, they may think this is hokey, but it's not, because it's the same thing that I just talked about with the laughter, what we were just speaking of. And what she said was this, and I'm going to quote her right here. It says, "With the fear and worry this virus has brought, I want to remind everyone that research shows love, gratitude, and appreciation help build your immune system. Truly, it does."
Right.
So then she says, this is her how. How you can build your immune system strength by focusing on love. Who do you love? What do you love doing? Where do you love being? Close your eyes for a moment, breathe that into your heart, and feel that. And then she takes it up into gratitude. So once you're really happy about, like, you know, I really do love that campsite that, you know, I get to go to every year. I really do love my couch. I really do love something, you know, my dog, my family, whatever it is, you know, the fact that the sun is shining today, then you can actually bring that and expand it more into gratitude, because gratitude is actually a higher vibration
right.
than
no,
even love
very,
is.
Very true.
So doing this, that's raising your immune system. I mean,
yep.
honestly, wash your hands and, you know,
well,
laugh.
We're actually at the break, we're going to listen to a bit by George Carlin where he talks about germs. I think it's really fitting. Getting people laugh at this whole thing. Like, I love germs.
Okay.
I used to swim in the Hudson River with shit and it boosted my immune system. So, you know.
That's right,
But let me get into this, you know, on that note, and thank you for that, Deborah. It will help.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first part of the hour, I want to talk about how we combat these crimes when obviously the state and big pharma are engineering these attacks on us, you know, the forced vaccination, all of these gloom and doom stories, realities that we're in. What is the effective way to deal with, first of all, on a public level, but then in the latter part of the show, I want to talk about how we do it personally as well, because the two go hand in hand. And let me just kick this off by putting something out there, that this campaign about vaccinations is just the tip of the iceberg, of course, and where we're dealing with a police state that does not operate according to the rule of law. And we have to think in different terms, because here's a standard thing I go through all the time. People, and here's one example. There was a case in the Vancouver court where a father is now being sued by the Attorney General because he challenged the forced gender change happening to his 14-year-old daughter. Basically, they went to the daughter in high school and said, it looks like you want a sex change, don't you? So they got her to approve it without parental permission. The father talked about it online, and now he faces criminal contempt charges by the Attorney General because he just talked about it. He broke a publication ban on the issue.
Wow.
This is unbelievable totalitarianism. And yet, the people doing it, what did? They grabbed a lawyer, they went into the Supreme Court, and the whole thing is arranged. We found this with the residential school crimes. The lawyers for the Indians could not raise certain issues having to do with murder by the Crown, murder and sterilization of Indians in residential schools. And let's face it, the things happening to people now, the sterilization of children by gender changes, the vaccines, all that was tread out on the Indians first. And it's just extended now into the broader society, so we all think it's a crisis, but this has been going on for a long time to the people we never see. And he's in the middle of this, and yet he's going to lawyers, and the whole thing's going to be arranged, and he'll be powerless. So I say to people, it's time to come up with our own solutions. The court system is controlled by the very institutions doing these crimes and the vested interests. We need to come up with our own citizen inquiries in common law courts, and that's kind of the basis on which we operate.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I was actually going to be asking you that. So it feels like we're right on the same wavelength with this. You know, I want you to address at some point, how does the common law, how does that help? How can setting up a citizen's inquiry help? What can we do in that manner? And so if you would, it would be great for you to address that.
Well, there's two aspects to any answer about that. There's the personal and the public. And it really starts, you know, you can't say to people, okay, let's set up a common law court. They won't know. They don't feel in themselves that they have the power or ability or, quote, permission to do that, because they were raised to think in very dependent terms.
I'm going to ask you, stop you right there, too. You're right. And yet I'm going to tell you that there's a lot of people that don't even know what that means. You say, let's do common law court, and they're like, do we bring popcorn?
Good point.
What, you know, it's like, I don't even know what that is, you know?
Exactly.
So, in addition, go ahead.
Well, we have to tailor the language to where people are at, definitely. But it's the idea that people think that if you follow the rules in society, that is statutes, which are brought in by government, you'll be treated right. You will be given rights, but they don't realize that it's the other way around. We only have the rights that we practice. They come into being by being practiced. And we have the inherent sovereign right to do anything as long as it's not harming somebody. And so it really says to the people, when the law is not working for us, when it's undermining us, when the Attorney General is going after citizens and robbing them of their own children for nothing because they didn't want to have their gender change, then the law, there's no accountability, and we owe no allegiance to it anymore. And so we take it back in our own hands. We're the source, like the Founding Fathers of America said, we're the source of political and legal sovereignty and spiritual sovereignty. That's the whole point. Mm-hmm. So that means that, yeah, there has to be an education process. We've got to teach people things about it, but not in the abstract, in relation to a very real issue going on, which is that we're all under attack now in a very serious way. So what it means is, I often say to people when I sit down with them, go into a community, okay, you're your own experts. You have the knowledge. Tell me what the issue is. And then I encourage them. I'm the catalyst. I say, okay, what do you think needs to be done? And often you hear the same thing, well, we should do this, but we'll get arrested if we do. And there's that fear that we hit right away, boom. And the reality is that they won't. Be, like I say to them, look, I've been doing this. I've been pulling the dragon's tail for 25 years, and I've never been brought before a court. I've never been sued. What does that tell you? They're the ones who are frightened, not us.
Well, I think what you made a good point there, too, when you sit down with them and you say, you tell me what the problem is, then they're able to verbalize, you know, and I'm going to say the whole week, we're able to verbalize it, and then it gets crystallized where we can actually, especially if we're in a group, it gets defined a little better. But on the other side of it, you're right. The next thing that does happen is, and I do this in my head too. I mean, I've done it before, and there's certain things in my life I'm just like, yeah, but. And I've got this wall that I construct even before I get the whole thing, you know, kind of nicely formulated. So then the next question that I think would help is if you asked me, if you were doing this process with me, and you said, all right, so then how would you see yourself applying that? You know, I don't know, I just can't. I said, well, you know, breaking it down into bite-sized pieces. So there's a wall here, and you happen to have a shovel by your side. Would that be best to attack the wall or dig under it, or can you go around it?
Deborah, you're breaking up a lot. You'll have to slow down and just say it again.
Slower?
Yeah.
I'll back up to her. If you and I were doing this, if you were helping me through a process like this, the next thing I would want you to do is ask me, you know, again, how could we, you know, instead of me being able to volunteer the barrier, then working through that, like, you're a great example, like you said, of someone that has faced this a lot. But I know that, you know, if I was given the opportunity to really look at it a different direction with some coaching, like, do we go around this wall or do we have a ladder or is that wall even relevant?
Let me answer that in relation to your own experience. Now, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about this, because in Salt Lake City for a number of years, believe it or not, people don't know this, but Homeland Security have been doing their own so-called investigation into what Mormons had been suffering at the hands of their own church. You know, the abuse, the tortures, the whole bit that you've described on previous programs. But, of course, all they're doing is gathering information. They're not prosecuting.
Exactly.
They're not doing anything. So,
exactly.
So in that situation, there's people who are working with Homeland Security saying, oh, good, the government wants to do something about this, when their common sense tells them, no, they're not doing anything about it. They're excluding the FBI and the Department of Justice, which means there's not going to be any prosecutions. So what are they gathering this information for?
Well, that's the perfect question to ask. I mean, just in I was visiting with somebody yesterday about this very subject, and she had been pulled into Homeland Security and had been interviewed. And it was interesting because she was saying that they had told her they had been investigating the LDS Church for 10 years. And she almost was like, you know, she's like, so what are you doing with this? And they said, well, we're gathering information and we're putting a case together. Well, how are they putting a case together? I mean, they've got, apparently they also told her that they've got over 1,000 testimonies. So with this 1,000 plus testimonies, and then they, you know, proceeded to tell her she's one of the last 20 that they're going to interview, you know? And it's like, what, do they have a set, like, is there a ceiling on this? But it's confusing to her, and yet what they did, the setup was, here's a camera, we're going to put it in your face, and tell us your story. And she's like, well, what do you want to know? Like, they leave it so wide open, and a lot of times, depending on where the people are, really, really investing in the fact that, oh, good, Homeland Security's here, and they're going to help. I'm going to give them everything.
Right.
I'm going to tell them everything I possibly can. Exactly, because then they will take this information and treat it respectfully, handle it well, and then I'm going to be justified, and justice will be served. And it's like, so if that's not being demonstrated, especially if it's been a 10-year, what's the statute of limitations? Like, how long does something get to have an investigation posed against it? And then...
Well,
another client of mine, or a friend of mine, also had, you know, she's gone to them. She actually called them and said, I've got victims, and they need to have their, you know, they need to have their stories told. And they're like, bring them in. And the next thing she hears from them is like, oh, you know what? We appreciate in getting all of those testimonies, over 20 of them.
And unfortunately, we can't help any of your victims because it's been too long. And she's super disappointed.
Okay, what? Right there, they're lying. Okay, right there.
Yeah.
The fact is that Homeland Security has no mandate for investigating these crimes. Their only mandate is restricted to human trafficking. Okay, mm-hmm. So they're saying by that by handing it over to Homeland Security, they're deliberately going to avoid the whole issue of satanic ritual torture, killings, all of the capital crimes that you've described and people have eyewitnessed. So this is what I mean. You've got to show people, look, they're gathering information probably on behalf of the church itself, if not the government. And
right.
In order to know who's who, right, to take out the people who constitute a threat. The RCMP did the same thing in Canada around the residential schools. The CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Television Corporation, they did the same thing. They pretended to come and do a documentary, and then they left with all the data. And so you cannot trust anyone but yourselves. And so we say to people, film yourselves, get your own testimonies out. That's how we did it in Canada. That's what rocked things, because we just put it out there. We didn't wait for permission from anyone. And that's the only weapon we have right now, the numbers and public exposure and embarrassing the shit out of these people.
Yeah. Well, when the demonstration about this latest example here, you know, that is clearly demonstrating, you know, really it's just data collection. And what they're doing with it, I have my own theories on. But at the same time, they're still not doing what the people that they are gathering or, you know, gleaning that information from, they're not doing anything in their behalf. They're not saying, this is outrageous. After, you know, say two or three testimonies. So we're now into thousands.
Here's the other thing, Deborah. When they said we can't do anything, they didn't cite what the statute of limitation is, because in capital crimes and murder, there is no statute of limitation on a murder case. Okay.
And yet they're saying that it's too long.
No, they're lying, because there is no statute of limitation when somebody's being killed. Or where there's a criminal conspiracy to cause murder, there is no statute of limitations. So they're openly lying to people. And anyway, that's one example, and I think it's a good one, because it relates to, okay, what are people going to do now in response to that? Well, as you've told people, stop talking to them, for one thing.
Yeah, you don't need to volunteer any more information, because all they're doing is figuring out who you are and then how to corral the situation better because of this. I mean, you know, they know then with that data how to funnel people, how to do the propaganda, how to placate, how to scare. And here we are with the virus scare, you know, how to really pull this together and how important. I mean, then they know. Here's the other thing that's so interesting. And they know your weak spot. They know the society's Achilles heel. They know that, like, you know, we're terrified. Americans are the world is terrified of germs. And what do we get at us? This thing that you can't see, but you might breathe it, or you might pick it up on your hands, or you might. So
that's important.
Quarantine. Yeah.
That, you see, that psychologically, what it does is it's like after the Cold War, there's no overt enemy that they needed to keep the arms industry going. It's a $1 billion-a-day industry, keeps the American economy afloat. So find an enemy. Who's the new enemy? A nebulous, faceless terrorist. And they could be anybody. It's like a germ. Mm-hmm. And totalitarian regimes always describe their repressive measures in terms of public health. The Nazis did it. Stalin did it. They described, you know, the people they were eliminating in their society as a threat to the public health. Literally, they were doing that when they were locking up people in the death camps and that. And
that's ridiculous.
But that's exactly in America the
same
thing
going on.
That's the reality.
Exactly, yes. Yep.
Right. Now, you know, this does segue really well. I actually hate that word because it's trendy and I don't like trendiness. But anyway, this goes well. It goes well into the next thing. It's a 6-minute clip from George Carlin. He's talking about germs, and I think it's really fitting. It just agrees to what you just said there.
Okay.
So we're going to hear George Carlin, and then we'll come back.
It's just one more way of reducing your liberty and reminding you that they can fuck with you anytime they want. As long as you put up with it. As long as you put up with it. Which means, of course, anytime they want. Because that's what Americans do now. They're always willing to trade away a little of their freedom in exchange for the feeling, the illusion of security. What we have now is a completely neurotic population obsessed with security and safety and crime and drugs and cleanliness and hygiene and germs. There's another thing. Germs. Where did this sudden fear of germs come from in this country? Have you noticed this? The media constantly running stories about all the latest infections, salmonella, E. coli, hantavirus, bird flu, and Americans, they panic easily, so now everybody's running around scrubbing this and spraying that and overcooking their food and repeatedly washing their hands, trying to avoid all contact with germs. It's ridiculous, and it goes to ridiculous lengths. In prisons, before they give you a lethal injection, they swab your arm with alcohol. It's true. It's true. It's true. Well, they don't want you to get an infection. And you can see their point. Wouldn't want some guy to go to hell and be sick. It would take a lot of the sportsmanship out of the whole execution. Fear of germs. Why, these fucking pussies. You can't even get a decent hamburger anymore. They cook the shit out of everything now because everybody's afraid of food poisoning. Hey, where's your sense of adventure? Take a fucking chance, will you? You know how many people die in this country from food poisoning every year? 9,000. That's all. It's a minor risk. Take a fucking chance, bunch of goddamn pussies. Besides, what do you think you have an immune system for? It's for killing germs. But it needs practice. It needs germs to practice on. So listen. If you kill all the germs around you and live a completely sterile life, then when germs do come along, you're not going to be prepared. And never mind ordinary germs, what are you going to do when some super virus comes along that turns your vital organs into liquid shit? I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to get sick, you're going to die, and you're going to deserve it because you're fucking weak and you got a fucking weak immune system. Now, God damn it. All right, let me tell you a true story about immunization, okay? When I was a little boy in New York City in the 1940s, we swam in the Hudson River, and it was filled with raw sewage, okay? We swam in raw sewage, you know, to cool off. And at that time, the big fear was polio. Thousands of kids died from polio every year. But you know something? In my neighborhood, no one ever got polio. No one, ever. You know why? Because we swam in raw sewage. It strengthened our immune systems. The polio never had a prayer. We were tempered in raw shit. So personally, I never take any special precautions against germs. I don't shy away from people who sneeze and cough. I don't wipe off the telephone. I don't cover the toilet seat. And if I drop food on the floor, I pick it up and eat it. I eat it. Yes, I do. Even if I'm at a sidewalk cafe in Calcutta, the poor section, on New Year's morning during a soccer riot. And you know something? In spite of all that so-called risky behavior, I never get infections. I don't get them. I don't get colds. I don't get flu. I don't get headaches. I don't get upset stomachs. And you know why? Because I got a good, strong immune system, and it gets a lot of practice. My immune system is equipped with the biological equivalent of fully automatic military assault rifles with night vision and laser scopes. And we have recently acquired phosphorus grenades, cluster bombs, and anti-personnel fragmentation mines. So, when my white blood cells are on patrol, reconnoitering my bloodstream, seeking out strangers and other undesirables, if they see any suspicious-looking germs of any kind, they don't fuck around. They whip out the weapons, they wax the motherfucker, and deposit the unlucky fellow directly into my colon. Into my colon. There's no nonsense. There's no Miranda warning. There's none of that three strikes and you're out shit. First defense, bam, into the colon you go. And speaking of my colon, I want you to know I don't automatically wash my hands every time I go to the bathroom, okay? Can you deal with that? Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. You know when I wash my hands? When I shit on them. That's the only time. And you know how often that happens? Tops. 2-3 times a week. Tops. Maybe a little more frequently over the holidays, you know what I mean? And I'll tell you something else, my well-scrubbed friends. You don't always need a shower every day. Did you know that? It's overkill. Unless you work out or work outdoors or for some reason come in intimate contact with huge amounts of filth and garbage every day, you don't always need a shower. All you really need to do is to wash the four key areas. Armpits, asshole, crotch, and teeth. Got that? Armpits, asshole, crotch, and teeth. In fact, you can save yourself a whole lot of time if you simply use the same brush on all four areas. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Oh, boy, yes. Good old George. I love it.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, the brilliant thing about that is that he isn't just talking physically, because in a spiritual sense, how is our spiritual immune system built up? Not by hiding, but by the conflict and loss in our life, right?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Morally, yeah. Intellectually, spiritually, we're strengthened by the shit we go through, not by avoiding it, right?
Well, if you're going to, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, and you really want to get serious about this question, but if you think about it, you think about the, you know, some of the worst things that have ever happened to you. I mean, just grab the top three and then grab the top one. Mm-hmm. And then think about the biggest gift, the biggest blessings you've ever had. Grab the top three and then grab the top one. And you will notice that it's one and the same. Typically, it is one and the same. The biggest challenges are our biggest gifts. And I will say that. I really actually will say that unequivocally with my experience. As horrendous as the torture and the rapings and the witnessing of the sacrifices and the murders and, you know, the blood and gore. I mean, really and truly, I'm saying this right now because what I have is experience that really took me into a very extremely dark place. And what that tells me as I've emerged from there and as I'm emerging further is I have got with the whole natural polarity, the way energy works in trying to find its equilibrium, I have got an incredible amount of light that I have available to me because I understand the incredible amount of dark that's there. And so being able to hold that and having that resiliency built up is a lot different. And I'm saying resiliency, not resistance, resilience, because of what you just said. You know,
right.
It's there. It's there for all of us. We can all relate to this.
Well, and the law of nature, too, is that everything has its equal and opposite reaction. So we find in the course of going through horrible stuff, its opposite appears right alongside it, right? And,
yeah.
You know, I think I gave you the example once of years ago I was in Nanaimo and all the power went out. And the first thought was, oh, boy, I can't phone people, I can't go on the Internet, blah, 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 all these worries. And then I thought, wait a minute, this feels different. And I looked out, and there were no lights on, and it felt wonderful. That electronic matrix we're immersed in was gone. And I had this amazing, expansive feeling inside, like free, this freedom.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was great without electricity. And I was sorry when it came on about 5 hours later, right?
Well,
it's like I wish it wouldn't have come back on. I hope the thing crashes because we're losing something, missing something by, you know, that natural energy that we're cut off from by these so-called good things and conveniences, right?
Well, you know, exactly. And that taking that example, I think that's pretty parallel to something I can relate to. With you had that moment where you had this expansion because, you know, the power went out and you had a shift in the vibration around you and the reality around you and what's going on. And you experienced it in a really pure form. So you had that snapshot, that 5 hour snapshot. And then once it came back on, you know, now you've since then you've had like days, months, years, whatever of the other, but you still have that snapshot to refer
right.
to. And so here, you know, I wanted to kind of take this into this craze, this the fear. It's immersion. I mean, we had like totally submerged ourselves, you know, and into this fear with this coronavirus. But what I would love to put out there is this maybe an appeal. Whenever it feels right, but an appeal for all of us to access our higher dimensional ability to dissolve this or dismantle this coronavirus and anything else that sells the idea that would deny our free will. And so what I mean by that is we are in this, but we've had snapshots. We have the ability right. within each of us to access that part that you just referred to, that spiritual part, that soul part, that the part that we, you know, is less dense, so we don't have the density to maybe even see it, but we sure can sense it. Again, like the laughter, you sense the joy. Just to go to that dimension of yourself, however you access it,
right.
to go to that dimension of yourself and then sit in that for a while. And what that does is it actually destabilizes the anchoring of this fear. So now it's more like you can be more buoyant. You can raise the anchor, so to say, and you're not going to be like, you know, you don't have the cement boots on, you know, drowning and all of this stuff. You can actually float on top of it.
I'll give you an example, too, of how it happened for me personally and how it links the personal and the public or the political, right? The time I was out, or one of the times, I was outside the Vatican in St. Peter's Square, and everyone was warning me. They said, look, a month before that, 12 Aboriginal grandmothers had tried to hold a ceremony in St. Peter's Square. They were instantly arrested by Vatican police for conducting a, quote, pagan ceremony, right? I was going to stand there and confront the Catholic Church over its murder of children. They said, you're going to get thrown in a Vatican prison if you try that, Kev. Don't do it. So, but what consumed me was, this has got to be done for those children in the ground. This has got to be done. And that's what consumed me. And I went there and did it. And not only did it happen, and I was untouched, literally the police were walking by me as if I was invisible. But the next day, that tornado hits the center of Rome, and the European media started reporting for the first time about Pope Benedict's involvement in covering up child abuse. It got blown open because of that ceremony and exorcism I did that day.
Yes.
And I realized it wasn't just my action, but it was that energy acting through me where there was an absence of fear and that determination on love and commitment for those children in the ground. And that has the power to overcome anything. And I learned that day, right?
That is such a great example, and it's a very huge example of what your intention can be responded to by that which is unseen. But it's not, we get this idea that I'm this one little person, or it's just me and my, you know, immediate family or whatever it is that's battling, quote unquote, this thing. And instead it's not. I mean, you called out a tornado. If you don't want to believe in God, you still had Mother Nature. Like, you know what I mean? There was an energy that was set forward. There was a quantum experience. There was, you know, a field, physics. There was gravity. There was all of these natural elements that combined because of your intention and what you put out there. We can change things. We can.
Well, exactly. And the image of, you know, Lord of the Rings, Aragorn walking into that cave after he's been given the sword, he's found his purpose. Mm-hmm. And he summons the dead, and they're the ones who won the battle against, you see, like we're like those human beings fighting the orcs and the armies of Mordor or whatever it is. And on our own, we can't do it. Something else has to be summoned from within us and around us. And that army of the dead, those spirits caught in limbo. And you know what's really amazing is that we're doing exactly the same thing. When I mentioned that thing on April 12th, we are summoning forth the dead.
Yes.
And there's no defense. The people who did these crimes, they have no defense against that, and they know it,
but
and they're terrified.
That is the case, yes. I mean, there is something that is, the dead will respond, whether it is literally the dead and those spirits that are waiting for a collection, a connection, a chance to actually step into that role, or whether it's a dead part of you, whether there is a part in each of us that can be resurrected and given a sword or given hope or given a match, whatever, you know, wherever you feel you can do it. But that inner being of us, I mean, my example, just recently, I mean, I think this was just days ago also, there's so much that's going on. I actually got a text from my brother, and he said, I'm cutting off connection with our parents, and this is why, and let me send you, and then he sent me the text that he sent to our parents, and he's like, I'm cutting off all connection, the abuse, I'm realizing, he's going through his own process, but one of the things that he said is, he said, I'm taking a page out of Deborah's book, and I'm following what she's done, and her example of not having any contact which was really powerful. And what I instead, you know, I celebrated with him by saying, that's really well said. That was firm. That was succinct. Expect it to be challenged, but stay true to this because that is your conviction. You know,
and to clarify for the listeners, Deborah, it was your both your parents or one of them that was involved in torturing you and your siblings?
It was my dad. I believe, you know, I my kids actually have memory of my my mother being present, so I know that there's a part, you know, she's there, but I think I don't know exactly, but I know that there's at least some form of understanding or knowledge or presence that's there, whether she's in drug state or whether she's in an altar. I mean, now we're getting into psychology and everything, but yes, the active one has been and still is my dad, our dad. And I cut off connection with them, oh my gosh, and what, 17 years? I had to cut off all connections. And in order to do that, the reason I did that, and I did that very, I mean, I had to kind of nurse myself up to that point, and then I had to write a script for myself to make sure when they were going to challenge that I had the same words to say, because my mind had not been programmed. My heart, my soul, my body, everything had not been programmed to stand up for myself in such a manner.
Right.
And yet I was having evidence that this was the people that were hurting me. And so I had to support myself very, very scripted, very, you know, until it became a confidence for me. And I had to get that support from myself through a piece of paper. I had this little 3x5 card I would carry around in case I got sabotaged, you know, a phone call came in or something.
That what's brilliant about what you're saying is that you inspired, and this is always the most difficult thing to happen within our own family. Out in the public is a lot easier by comparison, but when we confront the crap going on in our own family, that's where the most resistance and condemnation happens. And for him to be inspired by your example, that must feel amazing. I mean, that's such a great victory. And it's what we do. We pass it on and catalyze others.
It was amazing to me. Now, I'm going to throw this out here, though, and this is so important. This is probably the fourth time he has tried to cut things off, but not to this degree. This was a difference. I saw him. I saw him in his writing and in his voice and in his strength. His marriage is being threatened now. There's sabotage. I mean, it's kind of gotten to a really critical point for him, and I finally heard it in what he had written to his parents. But even the way he addressed them by a first name. It's not like I'm going to give you the dignity of having a label that is anything other than the name that you are known by now.
That's important.
Yep. And it is important. And so the other three times, it's been more casually to me where it's like, well, I'm done talking to him. That's it. It's over. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, good luck with that. And then it's not, you know, 2 months later and all of a sudden they're having dinner with him and going on vacations. And I'm like, all right, well, and what I'm saying is it is a process. We get the awareness, we get the frustration, and then we also get to see where it gets challenged, because that's not it. You know, like the government and our parents and our whoever that we're stepping away from, they're not going to say, oh, wow, you know, that's been a great ride. See you later.
Well,
they're
going to
say, oh, here's the challenge.
That's the thing. And I want to bring it back in the remaining about 12 minutes here. I want to bring it back to how this relates to what we're facing in the world right now, because whether it's a parent or another authority figure in government or whoever, church, they are forcing totalitarianism on us, and we all feel the need to, if not go along, at least avoid it and avoid the necessary confrontation that has to happen at some point. And I would just say to people that you cannot avoid these things.
No,
you know, you have to go through it and realize non-cooperation is the step now. Because the very fact that they're forcing this obviously contrived scenario of the coronavirus on people, when the infection rate is actually dropping in China and it's never reached anywhere near a pandemic level, and it's not even lethal in most cases, there's obviously another agenda going on. People have their own theories about it. But the fact that they're doing that, according to Sun Tzu in The Art of War, says that's a sign of weakness. They are desperate. When you do desperate measures, and that has to happen quickly, it's involving big money, and it's they have a timeline on this. So all we have to do is say no. And the more we say no, the more we screw them up. And people don't realize the power they have, but we can all do that, and it has a power greater than our numbers.
It does. What you're saying to me is that they have their own fair base. And the presentation and the marketing and the propaganda, you know, certainly are set up for us as a public to not see that there's anything but, oh, but this is in your best interest. It's very, very similar to when a parent says to a child, oh, you don't want that. I know better for you. I know what you want. And it's like, no, I actually want this. I don't want what you're offering me. And they totally disregard. We have been so, conditioned that way. You've said to me before, and this is a really great place to actually, you know, be reminded of this, that who sets the terms of the battle also wins the battle. So this is one of those things where they have set the terms, and because we don't know that we can say, I'm thinking that we'll do different terms. These are going to be my terms. Because we don't know we can give ourselves that permission, and we do feel so isolated, and we don't know how to challenge it. And that's the key that I find so fascinating. They are asking and encouraging and actually dictating us to go into voluntary quarantine, which means we're isolated, which means we can't commiserate, which means we can't really connect one-on-one anyway. And so with the isolation, how do we know that we can actually say, this is a different agenda. I have a different idea. I'm going to do this differently. We can't.
Well, here's how absurd it's getting. I just heard from somebody, a woman was arrested because she coughed and didn't cover her mouth.
Are you kidding?
And it's creating the climate of fear, right? She's in jail now because she didn't cover her mouth when she coughed. So this is hysterical. I mean, you know the old saying, the rot starts at the top, always. Mm-hmm. The craziest people are those in charge. And, I mean, they're the most disassociated. So you don't ever follow their lead, right? You follow your common sense and the people around you, and you know it's true. And,
You know. Goodness. Following common sense is definitely, so again, we're kind of going back to how what's the solution? What are steps that we can take? And again, I think one of the key things, and you were bringing this in, is the spiritual side of this, bringing this in by really getting very real with yourself. And whatever your belief is about the coronavirus, it doesn't matter. What your belief about the fear of it is what matters. That you think that you can do for yourself to maintain some happiness. Like, I, to be honest, I just found out today my daughter, she's lost her job. She's been put out of a job because her particular workplace just shut down until the end of April. You know, and so she's got tears in her eyes going, well, I don't know what to do. But then I start hearing her say, you know, I've been wanting to get to my artwork. Maybe I should pull out those brushes. You know, I could actually help people by going to buy groceries for them. You know, and she shifted it.
Right.
So there's a different thing for her, you know. So how do we do this? We raise it.
Yes, that's very important. And how you extend that to a broader level is you speak to the people in your community and say, look, this is all the more reason why the common law courts, our own inquiry, returning to the idea of a sovereign republic where people govern themselves.
Mm-hmm.
These ideas are now going to catch hold because people see in practice the importance of them, because the existing system is criminal. And if you have any toehold in that system, it's going to screw you around. So we have to declare independence. And Americans understand that better because you've already done it once. Harder sledding for Canadians because it's a slave mentality where you're taught that you're a subject of the crown, not a citizen of a republic. And so we have to do a lot of education, but you do that in practice. And, you know, I think
all
this is
practice. Absolutely.
This is what we learn. And just for people listening, those lessons are contained in two books that I urge you to get. The Truth Teller Shield, Manual for Whistleblowers and Hellraisers, and Common Law Training Manual. Now, unfortunately, you have to go to Amazon to get those books. And it's disgusting that we have to rely on this bloated multi-billion-dollar corporation to do that, but with enough support, we'll get out of that and just publish our own books. But we have to do these measures if we don't have the support. And so anyway, you can go to, that's a long rationale for saying, you can get the books there. Go to Amazon.com, write in Kevin Annett. And those books are essential for waging this battle right now. And like I say, March 30th, this Common Law Court in Vancouver, you can do this action in your own community. Convene an assembly. We have common law charters that can be issued where you can form yourselves as these courts. It's all there. The how to do is laid out. You just have to do it. You have to have the will, like you're saying, Deborah, to take that inner step and then the outer step. We've got about 5 minutes left, and actually less, more like 4 minutes. Any final words? Because we'll come back and keep doing this.
You know, the thing that keeps coming through to me is just the best way to really affect all of it, because we're all tapped into it. It's like we're all part of that root system. Is to the more that we can be in our own positivity, we pump back into that root system, into the system that is, you know, really kind of overarching all of it, our own positive virus. So honestly, if we want to get things changed, we can gather, but that gathering gets fed when we actually still continue to pump into the system, pump into the atmosphere, whatever is our own positive, higher happiness, laugh. You know, don't get, if you get anchored into it, know that you're there for a minute and then just do it. Okay, I'm going to undo that. I'm going to pull my anchor up and I'm going to bob on the top of this whole thing and watch what the adventure is. I mean, really, it can be that.
And what you said, echoing Sun Tzu, you don't respond to the terrain established by your opponent. You establish your own terrain, which means, no, this issue is not about a coronavirus. This issue is about the imposition of a totalitarian state on all of us. Okay,
right.
This issue wasn't about child abuse in Indian schools. It was about genocide. And now even the Prime Minister is using the word genocide. You stick to the right language and the right terrain, and it will come around on our terms. And I think that that's an important message to end on, and it actually leads into really well my ending song, which I love this song. It's Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around. It's sung by a young woman, and it was one of the hallmarks of the music of the Civil Rights Movement. And it does that. It engendered in sense of people, nobody is going to turn me around. You know, no law, no fear campaign, and that's a lesson for today. Deborah, it's always great having you on, and I love the way we're extending this beyond the kind of one-dimensional issue into many dimensions of consideration.
I agree. Thanks so much, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Deborah, thank you. We'll have you back. And for folks listening for the first time, murderbydecree.com is the website. All the work of our tribunal is archived there. Just look through the different things. There's also a donate button, and I really urge people to do that. It costs us about close to $300 a month to do this show. We need your support on the ground, and also we need your, most importantly, we need your active involvement, because it's reclaiming your mind and your world. We are facing a war of extermination, and that's the word for it. There isn't going to be a human race and free-thinking men and women unless we take a stand now for our children, for our future. So each one of you listening is a soldier in that struggle. Believe in yourself and believe in our power to make this change. I want to thank you all. Here's our song, Stay Strong, Stay Clear. We'll be back next week. Thank you.